Are we good now?
Man, I just said something really, really nice, and you guys didn't even hear it. So I was saying that the things that are the most frightening, now I cannot even pronounce the word anymore, and that are the most uncontrollable for human beings, they are not at all so for God. They are God's tools. And he is the only one who can control them, only one who can subdue them. They are part of his wise and holy counsel. Everything in this universe is part of God's wise and holy counsel. Anyone who challenges God about God's way of doing things must be, at the very least, misconceived in his or her conception about God, even if that person were the best that faith could offer on earth, even if that person was named Job. And tonight we are at the last part of God's two speeches to his beloved servant. God spoke to Job to make that very point, that he, not Job, is in control. And he challenges Job to ask Job, are you capable of doing what I'm doing, or are you capable of doing a better job? And if you are, here's a challenge, speak up. And if you are really able, then I'll pass it to you. You see, God challenged Job to prove that Job is not capable of governing the universe. Job is not capable of governing even his own life. But God is capable, and God knows what he's doing. It's not out of his, it doesn't slip through his fingers. Only God can govern what God has created. Only God dares govern what God has created. So the two speeches of God are indeed presented in this manner. The first speech of God, there he talks about the macrocosm of his sovereignty. And we explain it to be the big aspects of his creation. And God began the speech and ended that speech with a challenge to Job. In the first challenge at the beginning of the speech, in the first three verses, God challenged Job's conception. If you are that smart, answer me. You are actually impeding upon what I'm doing. You obscure things. Stop speaking. Don't you say that to some of your kids who think they know much better? And in this, God is not angry when he spoke to his servant. He asked questions to bring awareness. And in these challenges, God demonstrated both truth and love in a seamless manner. And as God continued in that speech, he proved, first of all, that his sovereignty is in the creation of the world. God made this world out of his loving, smart, and responsible initiative. Nobody was there to watch over his shoulders. Job was not there to judge, to supervise, to advise, or to inspire. Even at point of reality in Job's life, where Job was when God was talking to him, Job could not advise, conceive something better than what God has done or is doing. Another creation outside of what already exists, Job couldn't. Can you conceptualize something other than what is already in existence? Whatever you will conceptualize will be similar to what you know. You cannot create something outside of what is already created. You cannot come up with something better. And then God showed his sovereignty not only in the origin of the world, but also in the operation of the world. That's when he asks all the questions, who are you? Do you know? Can you do? And in this operation of the world, God gave that quiz to Job, first of all, about the inanimate world, where he talks about constellation and snow and all those things. And he talked them about them in a down-to-earth kind of language. And Job was fascinated. And then he also talked about the animate world, where he mentioned 12 different animals to talk, big and small, medium size, insects, and every one of them. And God is talking about them as if he had them in his back pocket, so to speak. He made them. He controls them. They are not a headache to him. He doesn't regret having made them that way. They are all in their lane as God has created them. And then God gave another challenge to Job at the end, where he challenged his contention. And that's where Job answered with his first confession. And he said, I am nothing. I mean, if he had started this way, we would not have had that long book. I am insignificant. I am insignificant. Now, God did not stop there. He had more to teach his beloved servant. And in that second speech, he talked about the microcosm of his sovereignty. He began with a declaration of that sovereignty. By microcosm, we're talking about the small thing, the things that stand on their own, an individual thing. And then we started 3 weeks ago, I think, where we started looking at the, maybe 2 weeks last week, the evidence of God's microcosmic sovereignty. And he chose two animals that don't care about human beings. You don't come in their lane. They feed, and nobody can stop them from feeding. They are sleeping. Nobody dare come close to them. And those are big things that overwhelm human beings. And for God, they are micro. They are just another toy, so to speak, in his hand. And what is counterintuitive or irrational for human from human perspective makes complete sense and fits pretty well in God's management. That's why we talked about this part last week on the Behemoth. We themed this, the evidence of God's microcosmic sovereignty, management of the absurd. Those things that appear to be irrational, counterintuitive, and yet that do make complete sense to God. The Behemoth, the supreme beast, is under God's control. We identified this beast as the hippo. And we understood, we learned 5 lessons last week from what God was telling Job, that it is God who decides the origin of all the animates in the universe. It is God who controls the sustenance of these creatures. They are his. It is God who provides abilities to these creatures. It is God who sets the boundaries of these creatures. They are his. It is God who ensures the protection of his creatures. And right at the beginning, in verse 14, God said, I created the hippo just as I created you. And just as I manage it, I manage you. The hippo doesn't talk back to me. Why do you think you can? So what appears to be absurd, to be counterintuitive, to be irrational, it makes perfect sense for God, and it follows his wise and holy counsel. Hard to swallow, but true. The complexities and the paradoxes of our lives are only complexities and paradoxes to us. They are not to God. It's clear, even clearer than day is clear to us. They are just normal ways of life for our sovereign God. And if you go to him and say, it overwhelms me, Lord, I don't understand. I can't, give me strength. Yeah, he can make you do all things through Christ who strengthens you. That's the best way to go about it. But not to go challenge him and tell him to change. What he's doing is the best way it should be. So with the second animal in this speech, We are learning about God's microscopic sovereignty again with the Leviathan. Of all the animals mentioned, God spent most of the time on this animal, 34 verses total, compared to the 10 he spent on the behemoth. Yet God does not say a great variety of things about the animal. But what God says about it, he says it with repetition to drive his point. He goes deep, he repeats it, gives very different aspects of that same thing. He looks at every angle. And at the end of that, Job is going to give a second confession, which we have already studied, in verses 3 to 5 of chapter 42. That's where he's going to confess his ignorance. Now, the behemoth represented management of the absurd. The Leviathan represents management of the stubborn, the unsubdued, the unconquerable, the unfriendly. And hence the theme we will adopt this evening to study Job 41, verses 1 to 30 through 34. This Leviathan, evidence of God's microcosmic. I'm telling those Leviathan, they get into you, don't they? Evidence of God's microcosmic sovereignty, management of the stubborn. You see, this Leviathan, whatever it is, does not adjust to men's lifestyle. Men's usual way of doing things does not affect it. It does not phase. It is not tempted by anything. What man does not tempt it. It's not afraid of any such thing. This Leviathan does not fear anybody, and everybody feels it. Yet God, no problem, controls it with no problem whatsoever. So to study this animal and glean the study from the study the precious lessons that God was teaching Job, I have passed the microphone. So we must first of all answer three guiding questions. The first question, you may see it or you may not. Why is there a discrepancy in the verse numbers in Job 40 and 41 among the translations? How many of you have a translation where chapter 41 has 26 verses? Any of you? Well, then, I don't need to answer that question. Yeah, 41. 41, and 40 would have 32 verses. No? Okay. Well, I will give the information to you anyhow. If you were to take my French Bible, you will see that chapter 40 has 32 verses and chapter 41 has 26. There is an 8-verse discrepancy between the two. Why is that? Well, most English translations follow the numerology that is in the Septuagint. And the Septuagint, they have 24 verses in chapter 40, and in chapter 41, they have 34. In my French Bible, they follow the numerology that was adapted for the Hebrew Bible. We are closer to the original in French. You know I'm kidding, don't you? And therefore, they have 32 verses. Not all French versions have it that way, by the way. They have 32 verses in chapter 40 and 26. So nothing is gained, nothing is lost. It's a matter of whether they pulled the last 8 verses they make those 8 verses to be the last part of chapter 40, or they make them to be the first part of chapter 41. So if ever something like that comes up, it happened in a few books of the Bible. Job is one of them. And in fact, I mentioned something with Esther, with the book of Ecclesiastes at the end of that book when we were studying it. There was a difference in numerology in that nothing was lost, nothing was gained. It was what was going on. Okay, first question answered, but I asked a question. I answered a question to which you didn't ask. Here's the second question. Is the Leviathan a real animal? If so, which one is it? Now, we tried to answer that question last week regarding the behemoth. The behemoth had been variously understood to be either the elephant or the rhino, or water buffalo, or dinosaur, like the brontosaurus that eat plants, and the hippo. The most famous among the two candidates have been the elephant and the hippo. In fact, in some of the older translation, they put the elephant in there. I have a French translation that has the elephant, and I have a newer French translation that has the hippo. But the modern scholarship have come to accept it as the hippo. And how did they get there? Comparison and process of elimination. All of the things that I said in verses 15 to 24 of chapter 40, they fit the hippo much, much better. And it also, in regard to geographical circumstances, it fits the hippo better. Same thing for the Leviathan, except that there are a few complications with it, which we will answer with the third question. So in regard to the Leviathan, let me answer the question by quoting an excerpt from one of the commentaries I use. It summarizes it very well, and what it says, no need to go further, because all the studies I made, they come to about the same thing. It says this beast has been variously interpreted as the seven-headed sea monster Lotan of Ugaritic mythology. They have interpreted as the whale, the dolphin, a marine dinosaur that survived the flood, and most likely the crocodile. And it continues, it says, the crocodile fits God's description of the Leviathan's back in verses 13, 15 to 17 and 23. It fits the Leviathan, the crocodile's teeth in verse 14, the crocodile's chest and undersides in verses 24 and 30, and its churning of the waters in verses 31 and 32. And nearly all modern translations pretty much put there crocodile. So that's the answer, okay? Hippo and crocodile, and that also fits the geographical area, the stories, and all those sort of things in the past. But here's the third question. Is that only what God is doing with that word Leviathan? And that's the third question. Does the Leviathan symbolize something? If so, what? Who? To answer that question, I will have Kimberly read. We will look at two other passages outside of Job that refers to the Leviathan. So go to Job, to Psalm 24 and verses 13 and 14.
74.
Psalm 74. you are watching.
You divided the sea by your strength. You broke the heads of the sea monsters in the waters. You crushed the heads of the Leviathan. You gave him as food for the creatures of the wilderness.
Now, Psalm 74 is a prayer that Asaph offered to God to deliver his people. God is able, Asaph argued, because God has delivered his people in the past against both visible and invisible foes. So God can do it here. And so in verse 14, the Leviathan is represented with numerous heads. You see, he broke the heads of the Leviathan. So that Leviathan has many heads. And God crushed all of them. So this is a past thing. And therefore, we have to look at the history of the people of God from the time that Asaph was speaking to say, what reference would God make of that Leviathan with many heads that God crushed? It's not something in the future. So God broke, when you look at it, in Egyptian mythology, there was a dragon with seven heads that represented the invincible and the invincibility of Egypt. And indeed, in many ways, they were calling it Leviathan. And God broke indeed Egypt to pieces with really no context to deliver Israel, his people. God crushes anyone who is his people's enemy. You touch God, you do this. They touch you, they are trying to touch the apple of God's eye. God himself puts enmity. He puts enmity between his seed and any other. And in the end, he crushes the head or heads of any other. So the Leviathan is indeed used in Scripture to symbolize mythical forces that rise against God's people. They are invincible if God's people face them alone. But they are nothing for God to conquer. And though the Leviathan may refer to Egyptian mythology in Psalm 74, we cannot help thinking that the Psalm may be referring to much more than Egyptian mythology. Crushing of the head is reserved especially to the arch enemy of God, according to Genesis chapter 3. But let's go to Isaiah 27, where it's even clearer. Verse 1.
In that day, the Lord, with his hard and great and strong sword, will punish the fleeing serpent, Leviathan, the twisting serpent, and he will slay the dragon that is in the sea.
Oh, the dragon of the reptile. This chapter 27 is part of the book of Isaiah, which is very often called the little apocalypse or the little book of Revelation, so to speak. And it means all the judgment that Isaiah has predicted. Chapters 25 to 27 contain unparalleled blessings that we call those in the book of Revelation, blessings upon God's people. And part of the blessing that God bestows upon his people is salvation or deliverance for God's people in chapter 27. And guess how that salvation or deliverance begins? It begins with crushing the Leviathan. Many commentators explain this Leviathan as a Ugaritic dragon because you can find it in Ugaritic. But my question is this. If that were what Isaiah was thinking, what would be the connection with the people of Israel? He's not talking to the people of the Ugaritic people. Why would Isaiah use a symbol which were not in the people's awareness and experience? I conclude that God used the words Leviathan and serpent together to refer to God's arch enemy, Satan. And it fits the context in the Psalms as well. And it fits the context in Isaiah. And it does fit the context in Job. Oh yes, the Leviathan is represented by a serpent in Genesis. That serpent in Genesis. In Job, it is represented by a crocodile, invincible, unstoppable, fearing no one but feared by all, unconquerable, very successful over those who especially are proud and arrogant, but no match to God. At the beginning of the story, Satan caused a lot of havoc, a lot of chaos, a lot of disturbance and pain. Yet he could not act outside of God's limit. He has to come to God, and God said, here are the parameters, and he could not go beyond. God created the crocodile as well. Man cannot tame it. Man cannot conquer it. It does not fear man. Man fears it. Yet God controls it at will. It fulfills God's purpose as much as any other creature, including Job. And with this in mind, with the sense that God is also fingerprinting the archenemy that caused all those things that have happened in the book of Job, with this in mind, let us see how God speaks of this real animal, but with the background understanding that the finger is pointing on Satan, God's archenemy. So there are three parts to that story, those 32 verses. The first part is in verses 1 to 11, where God says, look at that crocodile. It is unsubduable. It does not obey. you cannot tame it. In verses 12 to 25, it says that, look at that crocodile. It is unfriendly. I mean, the whole build-up of that crocodile is to fight, protect itself, and be mean. There's nothing soft about it. And in verses 26 to 34, he says, look at that crocodile. It is unconquerable. Men use all kinds of its own tools against it. It doesn't work. And in the end, what is left? I control the crocodile however I want. So let's look at this first part about this management of the stubborn, which is unsubduable, that men cannot subdue, but this in its own habitat, in its sphere where it lives and operates in the first 11 verses. The crocodile lives primarily in water. It cannot be captured as a fish and cannot be tamed. The crocodile does not cooperate with man's way of life. You cannot go and sign a settlement with it. You cannot have a peace treaty with it. You cannot do a transaction with it. Man cannot capture it in the water in its habitat with fishing equipment. Look at verses 1 and 2. Tools do not subdue the crocodile. Someone will read verses 1 and 2 for me, please.
Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook or snare his tongue with a line which you lower? Can you put a reed through his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook?
So you do notice that I pronounce Leviathan, and you guys pronounce it in English, Leviathan. That's fine. In Hebrew, you say Leviathan. Okay? All right. Just as the last time, the last part of tan is like the word Satan. You say Satan. So that's what that last part of it is pronounced, the same as Satan. In fact, when you are reading in Hebrew, you are reading nearly the same sound that you will hear when someone is pronounced Satan, Leviathan, Satan, Leviathan, Satan, Leviathan. You know, there is all those things going with the Hebrew text. So tools that men use generally to catch fish and big fish, they don't work for it. It doesn't work. Talk does not persuade the crocodile as well in verses 3 and 4.
Will he make many supplications to you, or will he speak to you soft words? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him for a servant forever?
Oh, I mean, you may try to have a peace agreement, as when you would have at a war with your equal, so that you might have a share of victor conquest type settlement. You come to the crocodile and say, okay, now I'm going to live in my house. Now you stay in the pond, all right? All right, let's sign this treaty. No, you cannot do that as you do with human being style. And you cannot have some kind of transactions with the crocodile. I give you this, you give me that, in verses 5 and 6.
Will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you bind him for your maidens? Will the traders bargain over him? Will they divide him among the merchants?
Transactions doesn't bring the crocodile to compliance. As men, all those things that human beings use to make, you know, you remember what God said? Here's the word, subdue the world. Isn't that what God said at creation? And God is saying, you are not able to do that. You can use your tools that generate successful, your talk that generates successful, your transactions, like the bargaining of a merchant to reach an agreement in a transaction. I'm buying this, I give you that money, can you change anything, you know? Or like entertainment activities with Pavlovian sensitives. You know, you take that dog, you give that dog something, and the dog does whatever you want, you know. Train animals in a circus, for example. It doesn't work with it. Threats do not work either, verses 7 and 8.
Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle. Never do it again.
Yeah, threats do not bring the crocodile to civility. Like using harpoons and spears, hand skill in combat are useless. Look at me, crocodile. I'm coming down to get you. Try it and you will never do it again. You might not live to remember what you did. And verse 9 in the first part of verse 10, tricks do not overcome the crocodile either.
Behold, your expectation is false. Will you be laid low even at the sight of him? No one is so fierce that he dares to arouse him.
Even if he's sleeping, you go and, are you okay? You know, trying to get him when he's sleeping is more potential for harm than gain. And then God says, here's the lesson in the last part of verse 10 and the whole of verse 11.
Who then is able to stand against me? Who has a claim against me that I must pay? Everything under heaven belongs to me.
Look at the counterintuitive application from the crocodile lesson. If one of God's creatures can be unreconcilable in its own domain. I mean, you go to it in its own domain and it says, I am not going to do whatever you want to change me to your lifestyle, let alone requiring God to change himself to adjust to our own lifestyle. The whole creation is his domain. The whole earth is God's domain. If you exist, you are in God's domain anywhere. Don't try to impose your way of life upon God. Be thankful that he allows you to be comfortable in his own domain. This is my earth. And you are in it. You are telling me, change the way it is so that you might adjust to me. And that's a lesson he's taking from even that crocodile. You don't go and tell the crocodile, I want you to adjust to me. Tools, talk, transaction, threat, tricks don't work. Be thankful. God, whose world he created is his domain, does not owe royalty to anybody. He doesn't have to pay royalties to people. He doesn't have to pay annual fees or monthly payments to anybody. It's his. And everything that exists is rightfully his. No one can tell him what to do with it or how to do it. Does that sound like sovereignty? Yeah. I mean, don't you, at one point in time, you tell your teenager, whose house are you living in? Remind me again. And then, going from there, verses 12 to 25, God shows the management of the storm. It is unfriendly. The makeup of the unfriendly is to keep everybody away. The whole thing about this thing is, don't come near me. You cannot penetrate me with any of your tools or anything. God made the crocodile with an awesome anatomy. Look at verse 12. That speaks about the general makeup of the crocodile. Chapter 31, verse 12, please.
I will not keep silence, counseling his lips, nor his mighty strength, nor his goodly frame.
The whole makeup of the crocodile is a wonder to behold. You look at this, Ukraine wishes that it has that shield of protection, doesn't it? It's a wonder. I mean, all those things. I have a crocodile skin belt at home. I think I bought it in Thailand. I bought it for my son, and he never wore it. And I thought, man, I paid a lot of money for that thing. But he didn't know how much value it was. So I took it. And then in verses 13 to 17, it talks about its impenetrable defensive and offensive mechanism. Listen to that, whoever is reading verses 13 to 17, please.
Who can uncover the face of his garment, or who can come to him with his double bridle? Who can open the doors of his face? His teeth are terrible round about. His scales are his pride, shut up together as with a close seal. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They stick together that they cannot be sundered.
So its scale, its mouth, the teeth, they are an impenetrable iron dome, to use an Israeli protective system from rockets. Defensive and offensive mechanism. The whole outlook does not give you the air of someone who is friendly. He tells you, don't come near me. And in verses 18 to 21, it talks about its whole general outlook when you look at him from afar. Verses 18 to 21.
His sneezes flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning torches. Sparks of fire leap forth. Out of his nostrils smoke goes forth, as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame goes forth from his mouth.
I saw there was a picture on the internet about a golfer who was actually maybe 200 feet away on the golf course from a crocodile. And the caption was, such and such golfer unfazed by the crocodile in the background was kicking his golf ball. And I look at it and I said, oh, that crocodile is just 200 feet away. I'm certain that guy kicked the golf ball and just got out of there. He didn't go and pat the crocodile on the back. So they were saying, I mean, this is terror back there. So what those verses are saying, it's the outlook of the crocodile, even from afar, is terrifying. It's not inviting, it terrifies. It offers no hint at all of desiring to be friendly. It scares anybody away. And then in verses 22 to 25, it talks about all that interlocking and coordination of this anatomy. 22 to 25, please.
I can't read it.
What verses?
22 to 25.
In his neck lodges strength, and dismay leaps before him. The folds of his flesh are joined together, firm on him and immovable. His heart is as hard as a stone, even as hard as a lower millstone. When he raises himself up, the mighty fear, because of the crashing, they are bewildered.
Its parts, every one of those parts, are massive. They are massive, they interlocked, they are coordinated, and they are loaded to go. I mean, Anytime, baby, you come there, they are ready. Even its rising up is like a war movement, not something that's graceful. You just get up and say, uh-oh. Scares you to death. So you look at this, still remember what is in the background and the finger pointing. Satan. And let's go to the third part where it's talking about the management of the stubborn, that it is the crocodile is unconquerable. The unconquerable cannot be hunted even outside of its usual habitat. The first part was getting it in water. This part, on earth. The crocodile was unconquerable with the usual weapons that people use at the time of Job. Oh, yes, I do watch on the History Channel how they try to capture python and how they have the contest to capture crocodiles. They get them, you know, I think it's a History Channel. I like those people. Swamp people. Yeah, swamp people. I like it. You know, I look at them. And they feed them meat and get that thing in them. Man, when they have to, they kill it with a weapon, back on the head. Nobody goes into water. Oh, I caught this. Let me put it in the boat. Okay, they do that. But we're talking about the time when there was not a rifle. And that's where they are talking about this. With the bare human thing, you cannot conquer this animal. So on earth, it cannot be conquered like other hunted animals with a bow, with this. So in verses 26 to 29, this animal is built to be impenetrable with the usual hunting instruments. Look at those verses, 26 to 29, please.
The sword that reaches him has no effect, nor does the spear or the dart or the javelin. Iron he treats like straw, and bronze like rotten wood. Arrows do not make him flee. Sling stones are like chaff to him. A club seems to him but a piece of straw. He laughs at the rattling of the lance.
So though that's his makeup, this defensive makeup. You cannot, even if that animal is on land and you are watching him and you are throwing what those things that you use on land to hunt other animals, doesn't work. You throw it on him, boom, and it bounces back. And then and I can imagine that crocodile said, man, those flies that are, they are bad. So then he says, not only that, his tactics are tactics to avoid. Not only his defensive, but his tactics. Listen to verses 30 to 32.
His underside are jagged postures, leaving a trail in the mud like a threshing sledge. He makes the depths churn like a boiling cauldron and stirs up the sea like a pot of ointment. Behind him he leaves a glistening wake. One would think the deep had white hair.
So, verse 30, its undersides are like a deflecting shield. And to know that when it's running on mud, it leaves those, when it's sliding on mud, it leaves those lines that shows those sledges that it has. And then its movement in deep water, like sea or river, when it agitates the water as if it were boiling. It causes foams as when you are boiling ointment and the foam is coming out. I mean, it just, if you have watched Indiana Jones, you remember when that stone was falling down and you have those crocodiles that are showing all the foam. That's the idea of what it's talking about. Its speed near the surface of the water creates a fuzz as when particles shine with light on the water. It has those tactics. You cannot penetrate him. You cannot catch him. And in verses 33 and 34, we are going to read, it's also unique in its tense. Let's read those verses.
Nothing on earth is his equal, a creature without fear. He looks down on all that are haughty. He is king over all that are proud.
This animal, this crocodile is afraid of nothing. But it is feared by all. Proud beasts, as much as proud men, fear it and fall prey to it. You try to show that you can match it and fight for it, it will get you. It will get you. You see, managing this sophisticated and difficult universe is not a small feat. We are talking about a single crocodile facing a human being. And God is saying, all of them together, I just control them, no sweat. God does all that controlling and managing without breaking a sweat. Everything stays in their lanes. God created the crocodile the same way he created Job. In Ezekiel, he's going to say, I created Satan as an angel of light. And Satan, we met a creature that God controls. Job cannot manage a crocodile. God can. God dares. You see, the events in our lives are often like the crocodile, unsubduable. Tools, tricks, talks, nothing works, does it? Unfriendly, unconquerable. Yet God allows them to be that way. But behind all of that, the devil acts as unsubduable, unfriendly, and unconquerable. God allows him to act that way for a time. But God controls him that he cannot go beyond the lines that God has drawn. God doesn't even have to put them on the sand. He just said, this is where the line is, and the devil will better understand where the line are. And only operate within those perimeters, as we saw at the beginning of the book. He was created by God. He cannot surpass God. He is not equal to God. God allows him to touch his servants, but still according to God's wise and holy counsel. But everything is and will always be under God's control. Oh, yes. We may not see right now that everything is under his feet. Isn't that what the author told me? Yeah, you look at it, it doesn't appear that way. It didn't appear that way to Job either. And it doesn't appear that way to us. But believe God, not me. It is. It is. And as we preach this morning, so shall I encourage you. Keep walking, brother. Keep walking, sister. Keep walking with your God. If you fall, get up and keep walking. You are in the right company. Your trust is in the right place. You are with the winning team. Yes, the enemy appears to be unsubduable, unfriendly, unconquerable. But it is not your job to subdue it. It is not your job to be friendly to it. It's not your job to conquer it. Guess what? Job said, God is going to subdue Satan under your feet. I look at this thing. I said, what? He said, oh, yeah. It's like when I put it there and I come and I like you as a toddler. Come put your feet there. I got it. You can pat the lion now. I got it. God is going to do that. It is all in his hand. Keep on walking. Keep on walking with him. Let us pray. Father, I have encouraged my people whom I love on your behalf to keep on putting their trust in you despite the fact that they may look at all those things they are facing that are unsubduable, unfriendly, and unconquerable. And God, you say, everything is according to my wise and holy counsel. It's not unsubduable to me. It may be unfriendly to me, but it definitely is not unconquerable to me. Everything is under your control. It's your world. We cannot compel you to change your ways to adjust to ours. We should not try. It will never work. Help us, Lord, to subdue ourselves to you, to be friendly to you, and to let you conquer us in every part of our lives. Therefore, may your grace and mercy dwell with your people. Give us strength. When we groan, pat us on the back. When we falter, carry us in your hands. When we cry, dry our tears. But hold our hands, even if you have to drag us. Help us keep walking with you and never let go. In Jesus Christ's name we pray. Amen. God bless you, brothers and sisters. May you have a wonderful and pleasant week with our Lord.